My paper is not the first to argue that we are witnessing in our age a remarkable fruition of scientific understanding. In many ways, a 2.5 millennia long culmination of the great inquiries of Hellenic civilization. But I've stepped out on a limb to suggest that this culmination represents a so-called consilient framework for ideas, for action, for our daunting contemporary challenges, something that we need very badly just now. I describe this framework as a kind of structuralism, a symmetric structuralism, one that recognizes the power of language, but also the language-like structures that exist in other realms of the natural world, as we're learning today. This consilient framework is not a foundational blueprint of reality. In fact, I discount such a possibility in my paper. So much as it's a highly useful way of understanding the structures of our experience, their interrelations, their generative possibilities. And indeed, as I argue in my paper, this approach seems helpful in clarifying a number of age-old dualities and confusions. Several speakers now have noted the present context of a protracted global economic crisis, and I think it's appropriate for us to talk about that a little more today. Let me suggest that this acute crisis is only one manifestation of a chronic crisis in our patterns of resource use, that is, our making of things. And it has the peculiar characteristic of being an unintended consequence of our own apparently successful logical designs. In fact, spectacularly successful, it would seem. Consider, for example, what we're doing here in this very room, and how astonished would be the people who worshipped up on that hill some 2.5 millennia ago, had they been able to look down here and see the future. We have the sounds and images of this event circling the globe. Many of us have arrived here in fantastic flying machines. We can routinely dine on some of the best food and drink from around the world. We all take for granted extraordinary powers of healing, and so on and so on. And yet, through these very activities and the logical structures that made them possible, we've set in motion a complex unfolding of events that, in the case of our economic system, has now resulted in a disastrous impact on the quality of life of many, many people. And the looming threats ahead, especially from resource depletion and most worrisome, I think, climate change, may well be much more disastrous over a much longer period. So these facts make us painfully aware of our current inadequate state of knowledge and ability to structure the world in ultimately desirable or even sustainable ways. That is to say, we've become painfully aware of critical deficiencies in our own modern theories of design. So I suspect our ancient friends would look down on us now with some mixture of admiration and no small degree of dismay. My own interest is in cities and towns, in their detailed structure, in the forces that bring them about, in how our actions result in good quality of life or bad quality of life for their citizens, and how this plays out over time in more or less sustainable patterns. So I'm an urban design theorist, or you could simply say I'm an urbanist. This is a particularly challenging field just now because it appears that the making of cities also plays a major role in our current predicament. For example, it now appears that the form of our cities, particularly the dominant form that has resulted from modern design concepts, has become a major contributor to resource depletion and to climate change. Evidence now show clearly that the way we organize and move around in our cities is in itself a major variable in carbon emissions and plays a key role in our health and our quality of life in many other ways. And it now appears that even the present global financial crisis itself had its origins in the sprawling, car-dependent modern suburbs of the United States. So this widespread pattern of settlement and the larger structure of exotic and unstable financial mechanisms that were described earlier that in part generated and supported it collapsed in a complex kind of domino effect of defaults and a spiraling cycle of severe economic disruption around the world. Again, this is a painful reminder that we are a long way from adequate mastery of the complex phenomena that we ourselves generate with our technological systems. It appears that at least part of the problem is that we don't really understand the kind of problem we're dealing with. That is, we're bringing to the problem the wrong set of interpretive models of its structure and management. This is a point that the urban scholar Jane Jacobs raised in the marvelous last chapter of her 1961 book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, in a chapter called The Kind of Problem a City Is. And she noted the progress of the sciences into the realm of organized complexity and the great progress that was made possible in fields like biology and other sciences of complexity, as other speakers have mentioned. But she noted also that we've not caught up yet in our theories of city and city planning. And this was causing horrendous mistakes and failures in the design of our modern cities. Of course, this is a very long story that begins, as so much does about our modern condition, for better or worse, in our common Greek heritage of ideas. And in my paper, I discuss the seminal contributions to modern design of Plato's idealism and Aristotle's hylomorphism, his theory of the transformation of matter into form. As many of you know, this is the ancient topic of mereology, the relation of parts to wholes, but it's still a surprisingly dynamic topic in modern design, especially so as we enter the cybernetic age, as we're dealing with the increasing complexity generated by computer systems and other kinds of complex operating systems that we're now able to construct, documented in, among others, Herbert Simon's landmark 1962 paper on this topic, The Architecture of Complexity. In a real sense, we're constructing these kinds of generative operating systems all the time in our rule-based economic processes, in technological, legal, and political systems, and in the specialties in which we're often trained and unfortunately often over-specialized and sometimes fragmented. But once constructed, these relatively simple rule-based systems play out in highly complex ways that are often virtually impossible to predict, particularly so if we are trapped in our specialist silos. So there's an urgent need to get out of these silos, to have events like this one, and to manage these complex systems better and the other complex systems of nature with which they interact. Fortunately, there are useful insights and approaches emerging, as I alluded at the beginning, within developing fields such as game theory, mathematics, algorithms, and other studies of complex systems, as John Barrow spoke about yesterday. As Jacobs noted, the corollaries with biological sciences are particularly instructive. The way that natural systems transform parts into wholes to achieve so-called emergent outcomes, and transform parts and wholes, I should say, there seem to be useful lessons in the natural phenomenon called self-organization, the adaptive and self-correcting evolutionary process through which systems achieve a high level of organized complexity. And let me suggest that this is a very exciting frontier for designers today. I discussed in my paper one design theorist who has taken this line of inquiry in remarkable directions, and he was mentioned earlier, the architect and mathematician Christopher Alexander. So I'll discuss him here by way of illustration of these larger issues. Alexander was a major figure in the early development of computer-aided design, and his work has had a lasting effect on computer systems and their human interfaces, manifested today in things like Wiki, the Mac operating system, the iPhone, and many software programs. But Alexander did pioneering work in the decomposition and manipulation of networks in design using object-oriented design modules that he called patterns. And using a hyperlink system to connect them in his landmark work, A Pattern Language. More recently, he's asked a deeper question still about the structural processes by which natural systems achieve their remarkable level of order, and this was documented in his four-volume work, The Nature of Order, and our colleague Nikos Tsilingros also collaborated in that work. And informed by his continued interest in topics of Mariology, Alexander came up with a remarkable set of conclusions for designers. One is that the parts do not simply make the whole in an additive sense, but rather the whole very often articulates the parts through a process of differentiation. Very fundamental point. Two, this process of transformation is transformation of previous wholes. Very rarely is it a tabula rasa kind of process. Three, out of such processes of transformation, characteristic geometric properties arise. Things like strong centers, local symmetry, alternating repetition, and the other patterns that you can begin to see here, which Alexander was able to group phenomenologically into just 15 categories, which I'm just going to show very quickly. And if you have a chance to look at the book, it's a fascinating account. Four, the aesthetic qualities that arise from these processes are, in fact, structural. This unity can be seen very easily in living systems, but it can also be seen in human traditional process. Life is a kind of geometric structure, as we're learning today, and quality of life is a kind of geometric structure, as Nikos alluded to earlier. Five, these characteristic properties arise because of the mutually adaptive nature of the morphogenesis, in which every part may well be adaptive to every other part. As a corollary, when we adopt a generative form that is not mutually adaptive, a generative form language, we get a distinctly different kind of generated result with geometries that may be much more fragmented and inefficient. Again, it has to do with the process rather than any sort of stylistic or even ideological approach. So it's a very structural phenomenon we're talking about. So let me briefly summarize the implications of these findings from Alexander and from other investigators who are finding similar results, and perhaps we can discuss them later. One is that our role as designers must be less about creating novel artistic compositions that stand apart, and more about context, more about learning to understand and to diagnose the existing whole, much like a doctor does, and then prescribing the process needed to improve it through an iterative cycle of qualitative evaluation, and then through a larger cycle of professional learning and ultimately cultural learning. Two, closely related to that, is that our role as designers is about managing these processes of self-organization so as to create desired outcomes. And we can think of this much like gardening, in effect preparing the soil and fertilizing and watering and pruning and so on, and adding trellises, yes, constructed elements, not as these sort of sole structures, but more as frameworks on which things can grow. And lastly, of course, planting seeds in the garden, packages of coded genetic material that have gone through an earlier evolutionary process. So that's a kind of a metaphor, but it's a one that I think is very beneficial. Three, closely related to that last point, is that we need to recognize and to reincorporate and readapt useful coded information from the slow patterns of evolutionary history. While many things have changed from a given moment in the past, many things have not changed. And it's crucial to begin with an evidence-based application of what has worked previously and add the adaptations that are needed to respond to current conditions. This is the way living systems grow over time and become more self-organized. Four, most important, I think, is that our current challenges are broadly comprehensible structures generated by the choices we ourselves have made and the generative structures we've created in the past. There is an intelligent way forward if we understand the structural nature of the processes that we're dealing with and the evidence-based diagnostic prescriptions that are available to us. Once we do this, let me suggest, a new world of possibility opens up to us, and a much more hopeful one. Thank you.